The Center for Disease Control estimates that more than 1 million people are living with HIV in the U.S. In spite of widespread education and prevention efforts, there's been little change in the number of new HIV infections. Gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men make up the majority of new infections, but other groups such as heterosexual women and African Americans make up a significant percentage of the newly diagnosed. The good news? New treatments have allowed people with HIV/AIDS to live a normal lifespan and reduce risk of transmitting the disease to others. But social stigma and the psychological and economic impact of HIV/AIDS still takes a toll on those diagnosed with the disease. This is Central Standard, and I'm Susan Wilson. Today we're exploring what it's like to live with the stigma of HIV/AIDS, as well as changes in who is most at risk to contract the disease and new treatment that improve the quality and longevity of life. Joining us today are Mighty Enriquez, nurse practitioner at Truman Medical Center. Good morning, Mighty.
Good morning.
And Sarah Nelson-Johns, counselor at the KC Care Clinic.
Good morning.
And Blaine O'Borney, he's a patient expert. So I want to welcome all of you to the show. And I guess, Mighty, if you would, give us an overview of the current status of HIV/AIDS. Who's most affected?
What I see in our clinic at Truman, it's really impacting communities of color. And that's where we seem to see the highest number of new cases. And, of course, we're a safety net hospital, so we see majority of low-income population. But if you look nationwide, that's where you're seeing the most cases in vulnerable populations of color.
So I guess I would ask the question, why vulnerable populations, why poverty and people of color, why do they factor into being most affected?
I think there's a lot of more stigma in those communities, and I think there's not as much early testing, and I think that really impacts, especially seeing people from those communities come in with late-stage disease, where in other communities where there's not as much stigma, you see more testing, people being tested early in the disease, getting on treatment early in the disease. And I just see less, of course, there's stigma about HIV in all communities, but you tend to see less in the gay community and more in your communities of color. And in communities where people are struggling with things like, where's their next meal going to come from? HIV prevention is probably not at the top of their list.
Sarah, you're shaking your head affirmatively over here. What are your thoughts about this question?
Well, I think when it comes to HIV, it is sexually transmitted for most of the cases, and sex itself is already in the closet. So we don't talk about what that's like, but if you're impoverished, and the concerns about your day-to-day living, you're probably not going to be health literate. You don't go to the doctor regularly. You don't do preventive things. You're probably not going to the dentist. When you don't have access to those things, you're not going to be as concerned about, well, I just don't feel well today. I wonder what it is. I just don't feel well. That's all. It's hard to live with financial stressors or not having access to jobs, schools, all kinds of additional things that you would if you had more money.
Now, Blaine, you're a patient expert in HIV. Tell us a little bit about your story.
My story? Being in the homosexual community, I find that it's pretty basic knowledge that to break the stigma on HIV and homosexuality, most homosexuals just generally get tested on a regular basis. It's been something for the last several, the last couple of decades that as a community we've just pushed to kind of help break that stigma. I personally have only had issues. It seems like people who are ignorant to the information about HIV, for some people, ignorance is bliss. So they just think the less they know, the less they talk about it, it won't come up in their life ever. But others, that I deal with on a personal level, they seem very, very open towards learning about it, asking questions, finding out, you know, who's most at risk.
Now, Sarah, I guess you could say there's still a lot of fear among some groups of even going forward to get testing. Is that true?
Yeah, if you go to get tested, sometimes people are even afraid that they're going to be seen in a place that does testing. The nice thing is that people can now purchase over-the-counter testing kits, but then they may be even more isolated if they do get a positive result. So we are afraid of what will happen if someone knows our name, if we're spotted somewhere. And when we have those kinds of fears, we're just not going to access all the services that are out there. In reality, everybody needs testing. Everybody needs routine screening. It should happen in medical centers all the time, but it doesn't.
Well, is the fear justified? I know people are concerned all the time about the security of information in general and even health records, which are supposed to be protected. But is there a legitimate fear of people knowing that you've been diagnosed?
I think it's different from, is there a legitimate fear, like, would your name be published in the paper? Of course it won't. But people are afraid that their community will ostracize them. And unfortunately, in some of the smaller communities, that will happen. The more the communities of color or the more religious the community, the more likely it is for that person to not be accepted anymore or even to be kicked out of their family.
So in the spirit of full disclosure, I will say that I used to be on the Ryan White board for a couple of years, and I know that they've been doing a lot to try to improve awareness and that sort of thing. Can you say a few words about this effort and whether it's made a difference, Sarah?
The nice thing is that the Ryan White system provides a lot of points of access for patients. So it's not just that you'll have a doctor that you can go to if you're in the Ryan White case management system, but you'll have a case manager that works on your side. You can have access to therapy. You can work with peer educators who know what it's like to live with the disease successfully. You can have access to nurses, pharmacologists who specialize in it. You can go to support groups. You can even go to the planning council. So there's a lot of options out there for someone to get involved and feel like they have some control over their life and the disease.
So when, you know, when AIDS was a new disease in the 80s, there was a lot of misconceptions about how the disease was spread, and it really led to some really sad and unfortunate discrimination. Has this changed? Blaine, what do you see?
I personally do not see that it has changed much. There is a huge gap between the information that has been back in the 80s and the information that there is today. Simply because the education about it has not been pushed as much as it should be. But also it's a very uncomfortable thing to deal with. Anytime that you have death that's involved with a disease, especially as widespread as it was when it first came about in America, I think it's just something that's uncomfortable for people to talk about. When you have somebody who is an expert in it, whether they're positive or not, and they're open to talking about it and educating, pushing the information, it just seems like it opens up a whole new realm for people to kind of help drop that stigma and even push the new information that's out there.
How about the rest of you, Dr. Enriquez, Sarah? What do you say about that? Has there been a change in the level of misconception about it?
Well, I will say again, it depends on the community. In some communities, yes, there has been great change. In others, as you said, very little. Unfortunately, it's unfortunate that in this era, when we have such excellent treatment for HIV, people are still afraid to get tested. As you pointed out, Sarah, they're even afraid to be seen in a testing center. And yes, you can buy an over-the-counter HIV test if you can afford one. But then if you test positive, you still have to enter the healthcare system to get treatment. And honestly, I've had patients that do not take their HIV medicine because they don't want to go to the pharmacy, because the people working at the pharmacy know the prescriptions. And yes, I realize the pharmacist is a professional, but there are other people working at that pharmacy that, like, are their neighbors, live in their community. And so they're so afraid that a person will know what medicines they're taking, they won't even go to the pharmacy to get their prescription. That's if they even came in to get to a healthcare provider to get the prescription. So that's a very long answer to your question, but those are the huge barriers in this disease that are very hard to overcome.
We're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and with us today, Dr. Maite Enriquez, nurse practitioner at Truman Medical Center, Sarah Nelson-Johns, counselor at the KC Care Clinic, and Blaine O'Borney. He's a patient expert. So, Kansas City, are you or a loved one living with HIV/AIDS? What's your experience daily with the disease? Kansas City, join the conversation by calling us 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So everyone talks about how Magic Johnson was an example of being able to live long with HIV, with AIDS, and he's had a positive impact on stigma. But could his example also send the message to some people that contracting AIDS is really not a big deal anymore? From a prevention standpoint, Sarah, what do you notice?
Unfortunately, with the younger population, there does seem to be some of that misconception that it's not a big deal to take a pill every day. The reality of having HIV right now is that there's no reason why it has to shorten your life. Our treatments are fantastic. The medical treatment that you can get, the support you can get, there's no reason why it will end a life sooner than it needs to. You can have the same lifespan as everybody else. But I don't want to misconstrue what it's like to live with HIV. For a lot of people, you have to get your mind wrapped around that idea of I'm healthy with a disease, and that can be a very difficult thing to do. Magic Johnson has been wonderful because the media knew who he was, embraced him, definitely spread the word about treatments being out there, and he's a great example. But it is not an easy thing to live with taking these medications every day, going to the doctor four times a year, getting your blood taken, having a lot of people know a lot of things about you. It's a difficult thing. It's a burden to live with HIV. Even if you do get to live the same lifespan as everybody else, it's still hard.
Well, what about visibility? Has the disease had reduced visibility because now there's not this latest celebrity who's living with HIV AIDS to kind of champion the cause? What do you think, Maite? And also, Blaine, I'd like to hear from you.
I'll just give you a short example is that some of the younger students, you know, I work at the University of Missouri, they tell me, until they talked to me, they didn't even realize HIV was that big of a problem in the United States. They thought it was like a problem like in Africa. So.
And I guess for them, it's something that happens to those other people.
Exactly.
Blaine, what are your thoughts?
Well, I definitely think that if we had somebody in the media that was more up to date and more focused on pushing a new stigma with the disease, that it would definitely help out a lot. And getting back a little bit to the living with it versus taking medication, the younger population does seem that it's okay just to take a pill. They don't have to be as careful. But when you have somebody that is willing to share a personal story about it, in terms of how sick you can get, you know, from going from being perfectly happy, healthy to a couple days later, you're deathly ill. And sometimes doctors don't even know what's going on if they have not been trained in this field. So,
in turn, you know, you're talking about the pill that you take daily. Can anyone speak to the issue of how does this one pill work and when did it come on the scene? Maite?
Oh, we've had one pill once daily treatment for a number of years. And now we have four, soon to have five, options of one pill once a day. So what it is one pill that has three or four medications in that pill. And, you know, it's not like a huge pill because that's always the fear. Well, how big is this pill? No, it's they're small.
Because years ago, that was one of the barriers. Oh, you had to take, 10, 12 pills a day?
Absolutely. When I got into this area of healthcare in the 90s, yes, patients were taking handfuls of pills that had terrible side effects, and patients would tell me that they'd rather just live with the disease than all the side effects of the pills. But that is not the case today.
I think the one pill a day option, now that it's out there a bit more, has really, really decreased some of the fears that people have. There is just naturally a lot of people who just don't like taking pills in general. So this makes it so that they can approach healthcare much easier and have much fewer side effects. Rarely do my clients complain of long-term side effects. It's usually a day or two when they first start their medication. Then after that, they feel great.
Now, Blaine, you talked about the importance of people putting a face and a story behind HIV. Can you talk about the experiences you've had with discrimination since you found out you were HIV positive?
Typically, the discrimination that I have dealt with is normally when somebody finds out, they immediately, one of the questions that's immediately asked is, well, how did you get it, first of all? And then a second one is, it's kind of more of an apologetic thing that because they don't understand what's going on with it today, and it's an immediate, how long do you have to live? So that is, I mean, it I don't know. I am also a model in my part time, so I don't know that it would be, most people are shocked when I tell them that I live daily with HIV. I just made a lifestyle change. I exercise. I have a good diet. I'm generally happy. The medication doesn't have much of a side effect for me. There might be maybe an hour every day where I have a little drowsiness due to one specific type of medication in my pill. But that can be reduced by taking it either in the morning or at night before I go to bed, kind of my choice. The stigma, the issues I've had, people... It seems like an older population are less willing to learn about it, and they just think they know what they think they know, you know, based on what was said about it back in the 80s. And then a younger population, when they look at me as an example of someone today living with the disease, they're like, well, how is it possible that you can look like this, or that you can be so happy or be so healthy and have this disease? And so it's a simple, it breaks the ice right there.
Because people still think that someone who's living with the disease looks sick, and
right,
that's just not true.
Right. That's very true. You know, there are some different side effects to, or not really side effects to having the disease. Most people are more prone to opportunistic infections and cancers and such. But when you go to the other side of, you know, preventative measures, getting more sleep, taking vitamins, having a good diet, exercise, you can reduce all of those risks, just like any normal person would.
Well, there was a period where certainly housing discrimination, people who had HIV/AIDS faced housing discrimination. They faced employment discrimination. Now, I think there's been more laws in place to prevent that. But does that still exist, Blaine?
It does a little bit. I have not had any personal issues with it. I've heard some stories and read some things. I do public speaking in high schools mainly, because it seems like ages 13 to 24 is the majority of new cases today. So that's where I really target. And I just with my personal experience with it, I've not had any discrimination, you know, in my job, in my workplace, in my living space.
So it sounds like, at least based on your experience, we're making some progress on that front.
I would say we are.
Now, I know there's also discrimination as far as dating goes. Sarah, have you found that people that are on your caseload suffer from problems finding love or creating relationships? And that's a basic human need to have intimacy and that sort of thing.
I find that people who are newly diagnosed tend to have two strong reactions to the diagnosis. One is to shut down, to avoid people, to isolate. So I have some patients on my caseload that are, 10, 12, 15 years into this and have chosen not to date since then. That's a pretty harsh way to approach this. There's no reason why you can't have a relationship. They're scared of saying, I'm positive. Some of the other people react by telling everybody. And really, there has to be a middle ground for this. There has to be a place where you know whether or not you trust someone. So I encourage my clients to slow down, to make sure they get to know someone. I wouldn't tell just anybody on the street my personal information, so why would I tell someone on a first date? And I think it's important for people to know, is that person worth having a friendship with? Ultimately, any relationship we have has to have friendship as the base. And if you have that, then there should be some trust. There should be some ability to share one another's secrets, and you shouldn't be viewing yourself as the burden in the relationship. So someone who's positive and someone who's negative, they can have long-term relationships, stay safe. There's no reason why they can't be together. But really, the person may have to educate someone that they want to date about the fact that it is safe for them to date. There's no reason why kissing is a danger. Some of those old stigmas about kissing, toilet seats, using utensils, some of those things are still out there. So the person who wants to date may be the person who has to educate the other people.
But of course, the question always comes up when a relationship gets more serious about sex and having safe sex. How do you have safe sex if someone has HIV? Mighty, do you have some ideas about that?
Well, the most important thing, I think, first is to get on treatment and get your viral load undetectable, because that in and of itself reduces the risk of transmitting HIV through sexual contact by 96%. And then on top of that, to use barrier protection. With that said, I also have patients that are having families and, doing all kinds of wonderful things, living normal lives. So, that's the happy part of HIV, which is where I would like to see all my patients. But as Sarah pointed out, to get to that point, you have to first deal with some of the other issues.
Blaine, what about the relationship angle? What are some of the complications there in terms of finding, a partner or someone to have a companionship with or an intimate relationship?
For me personally, as you said, sexual contact is a huge human nature, something we just generally always seem to have to have. I find it not easy, but I don't find too many struggles in finding somebody that's a potential for a relationship. Simply because I'm so knowledgeable about this, I can go to scientific levels to be able to explain how it works better. Like she said, 96% less likely to spread it on medication being undetectable alone. That's a huge significant difference. And then if you add a barrier on top of that, you've practically taken all of your risk out of the equation. And then you throw on top of it that they're releasing medications today for a serodiscordant couple. Serodiscordant meaning one is positive, one is negative. The negative person being able to take a medication to protect themselves from the virus.
So we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be discussing how treatment for HIV/AIDS has brought hope and changed the outcome of this disease. Central Standard will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Susan Wilson. Our guests today are Dr. Maite Enriquez, nurse practitioner at Truman Medical Center, Sarah Nelson-Johns, who's a counselor at KC Care Clinic, and Blaine Orborny. He's a patient expert, and we're talking about HIV/AIDS. What has been your experience with treatment for HIV/AIDS, and what's particularly been helpful for you? Kansas City, tell us your thoughts by calling us 816-235-2888, that's 816-235-2888, or post your comments to Twitter. We are at KCURCST. So we were talking a minute ago about the whole issue of stigma and also disclosure. And I guess I would ask the question, Blaine, how do you and when do you disclose the fact that you're HIV positive to others?
That's a good question. I think it's a level of personal comfort. When I first was diagnosed 3 years ago, it was a very traumatic experience for me. I myself didn't know much about it. I felt lost, alone, scared, and I didn't know how I would ever talk to anybody else about it. It seemed like the more that I talked about it, just like any problem or negative situation in life, the more you talk about it and release, I find it easier to talk about in general. I am very open about my status simply as an advocacy for other people living with HIV, just saying that, you know, you don't have to be, for the people who are positive, you don't have to be closed off. There is hope for humanity. And then on the other side, not being positive, for maybe people who were affected by it, just saying that there's a lot of we're making advances today. There are passionate people that are willing to teach about the advances, as well as help in the prevention side, just trying to keep it from becoming an even bigger problem.
Now, who did you first disclose to, and what was their reaction?
My first disclosure was my oldest sister, and she was living in Portland, Oregon at the time, which is, 32-hour drive from where I was living in Kansas at the time, and it was very hard for her. She started crying immediately. She didn't know what to say, didn't know what to ask. Basically, I just told her, I'm with a really good doctor. I'm in good hands. I'm going to be taking medication to control this, and as I learn more, I'll teach you everything that I know. She's 10 years older than me, born in 81. I was born in 90. So that makes a huge, that creates a huge gap there.
So she responded positively?
At first it was not, but then because I stayed positive with it, already having the upper hand, having being told a little bit before I left the doctor's office that I'm not going to die from this, that it was HIV and in fact not AIDS, that my lifespan, if I should live to be 80 or 100, that I would live to be 80 or 100. They told me that right away just to help calm me down. So, yeah, it did go from a negative reaction into a much more positive reaction.
So, Sarah, I'm curious. It sounds like your situation, Blaine, turned out pretty well in the end. But what about patients who tell family members and their family has a very negative reaction, perhaps even cuts ties with them? How do you counsel, Sarah, patients who have that experience?
It's a very sad and unfortunate thing when that happens. But we all have to recognize that we can't control our families. We can't control their reactions. But we can gather people around us who are supportive, whether it's friends, coworkers, even just our medical providers. Sometimes my clients really do say that the only people they can talk to about this is their medical providers and their therapists. And we want to expand that circle. But there are people out there who are willing to embrace them, who know enough about HIV to know that there's no reason why they need to ostracize them. So we try and focus on what can you gather around you and how do you minimize the damage that someone else might do in rejecting you.
We have an email from Kevin, and Kevin says, I've been HIV positive 25 years. As a longtime survivor, I know how hard it is to live with the disease. Adding in the challenge of aging and medication side effects can make it even trickier. I take about 20 pills a day and have lost my teeth, have had both hips replaced, and live with daily pain. Young people need to realize the reality of not having safe sex. What about Kevin's experience? Is his experience typical, Mighty, in growing older with the disease?
Well, years ago, we didn't have the excellent treatments we have today. And the treatments we had you know, in the early 90s, I'm grateful we had them. They kept people alive, but they also had a lot of toxicities and long-term side effects. For example, the example of having to have hips replaced was probably from getting avascular necrosis, which, you know, we saw that more years ago. We don't see that as much now, if at all, with these newer treatments. Now, with that said, we don't know very much about aging with HIV. We know a little, but, you know, you have to remember that all the people that are aging with HIV are pioneers, if you will, because until recently, you know, we're talking now about, like you said, when you were diagnosed, they told you, oh, you'll live to be 80, 90, 100. You know, we didn't used to be able to tell our patients that. So it is, there's a lot of still uncertainty and unknown about aging with the disease and what will happen. So the experience that he's describing in that email is not atypical of people that have been living with the disease a long time and were diagnosed 25 years ago.
Now, we've talked about some of the physical impacts potentially of the disease, but I imagine the psychological impacts can be just as great. And I know, Blaine, you touched on that. What's the range of reactions, Blaine, do you see friends, people that you know who are newly diagnosed having when they first learn they have the disease?
Well, for instance, I have a friend who thought that he might have HIV, so he had went and got tested. He called me to ask if I would escort him to his family and speak about this and support his decision to not take medication and let it take him. Of course, being, you know, it's everybody's own personal decision whether they take the medication or not. So I've seen a very negative reaction to it. Mine took about 6 months to turn around. I went from being scared and feeling alone into being knowledgeable about it, getting into an exercise routine, changing my diet, feeling much better, going into being undetectable, getting my CD4 levels back up to a more normal level. So I think people are as happy as they allow themselves to be. If you realize that the situation is not as negative as it used to be, rather than going into this, oh my, what am I going to do? This is the end of the world right away. Just stopping that, being able to stop that initial reaction of, and it's hard to do, stopping a reaction of being scared and feeling alone, but being able to just remind yourself to breathe. I'm surrounded by professionals. Mm-hmm. There are people out there who have experience with it, who work in the field, who are there to support. Now,
Mighty, I imagine that you see, though, a fair amount of people that really develop depression or anxiety as a result of being diagnosed with the disease. How do you manage that mental health issue on top of the HIV issue?
Well, and also there are people who were already depressed before they got diagnosed. And so that is also an issue. And people have comorbidities in addition to depression, other mental illness, substance abuse, alcohol abuse. And so all of those things play a role when you're trying to treat a disease like HIV. And in addition, people have other chronic diseases, diabetes, etc. So, it can be very challenging.
Sarah, what have you seen in terms of either encouraging people or connecting people with mental health treatment?
Well, we have to recognize that about 85% of people with chronic diseases will at some point in time experience depression. Mighty's right when you talk about the fact that you may have depression before you get the diagnosis. That diagnosis itself can cause a grief and loss reaction, and the grief and loss is about what I thought my future would be. Especially if you're in your 20s, you think you're sort of immortal, and it takes a while to get used to just aging, and aging with the idea of I have a disease can be difficult. So if we actively treat depression, and And I actually want to see every patient I have do what Blaine does, exercise every day. That actually treats almost every disease out there. If you do that, if you manage your weight, if you take care of yourself, if you get enough sleep, you eat well, all those things, we all feel better. And I practice what I preach, too. Just for my own mental health, even though I don't live with the disease, my own mental health is better when I eat well, when I exercise. And I know my overall health is better. This is really a prescription for almost any American out there, especially with our obesity issues.
So is it fair to say that HIV has become very similar to any other chronic disease like hypertension, diabetes? What would you say, Mighty?
Similar from a treatment point of view, but I think that there is no other disease, no other chronic disease that has the stigma that HIV has, and that makes it very different in my opinion and what I see. That's the big difference in treating people with HIV and treating people with other chronic diseases like diabetes, if you will.
We blame people for being positive, and that blame is just so awful and really only puts people in even more of an isolation. We don't blame people for getting cancer. We don't blame them for having high blood pressure. In fact, we give them support. You know, oh, here's a medication. It will make it easier. We'll offer them all kinds of things, and they can openly talk about this. But we blame people for HIV.
Well, you know, and that may lead to another question that I have. There's been two decades worth of work of prevention for HIV/AIDS, and yet the new infection rate is pretty much stayed unchanged. Why haven't we been more successful in reducing the rates of infection?
I would personally say it's simply in the heat of the moment, people typically just do not think about using a barrier. Another issue is that people are so afraid to go get tested. You could live with this disease for potentially 5 years or more and not even know that you have it, but still pass it on to every single partner that you have. That is a huge issue.
So there's a lot of people who don't even know that they have the disease and so therefore continue on with their lifestyle and sexual habits and spread the risk, in other words.
That's very true. My personal experience with it about 6 months after my initial, you know, actually being infected, had an initial infection where I got extremely ill. That might not be typical, but it does happen. And I think it might happen to potentially everybody. Your immune system just has to be able to give the virus that type of initial avenue to get in and take over your immune system.
Yes.
I want to just emphasize the point that was made about people who do not know they have the infection. There's data out there to show that really fuels the epidemic. Once people know they have HIV, the majority of people take steps to not transmit that to another individual. And so that's why I would like to put in a plug for testing. And as we mentioned earlier, everyone who gets health care should be getting an HIV test as a routine part of medical care, but it is not happening.
And it doesn't have to be done just at specific testing sites. It can be done at any doctor or health department.
Even dental clinics.
Yeah.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Susan Wilson. With us today are Dr. Mighty Enriquez, nurse practitioner at Truman Medical Center, Sarah Nelson-Johns, counselor at KC Care Clinic, and Blaine O'Borney. He's a patient expert. We're discussing HIV/AIDS and the stigma surrounding it. Have you or a loved one faced discrimination or stigma related to HIV/AIDS? Share your experience by calling 816-235-2888 or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I guess the other question that I would have in terms of HIV, do we have the practitioners in the community, the primary care doctors, who may be the first person that suggests a test for a patient? Are they educated in terms of how to help patients that are diagnosed with AIDS? Do they know who to refer them to? Blaine?
My personal experience through my initial infection, I was ill for 6 weeks and went through every other test except for an HIV test because my doctor just generally did not know about HIV. And I dropped 50 pounds, went into a wasting syndrome, and finally I was referred 2 hours away to an internal medicine doctor who happens to specialize in HIV/AIDS. And I walk in the door, tell a few of my symptoms, and they immediately knew what it was. They said, we're going to give you this rapid test. It takes 15 minutes to find out. If you have a positive, we'll then do a conventional blood test and to confirm it. And sure enough, it was that simple. I know that there are some organizations that do send people in to educate health staff. Maybe you were a doctor who went through schooling 30 years ago, and there's not, you know, you just don't have that knowledge that's available today. I think if it was a standard that doctors should touch basis on HIV today when they're in school, kind of like just in school in general, healthcare, you know, health education in high school as a freshman, it should all be up to date and talked about regularly.
Yeah, because that could be a real concern. You're going to your health provider thinking that they would be up on all kinds of infectious diseases, only to find out maybe they're not.
We see a lot of routine screening in doctor's offices that are attached to hospitals. And I remember when I was pregnant, I was tested for HIV twice. It happens at the beginning of a pregnancy and at the end just to make sure that everybody's safe. But the smaller practices that are on their own, they don't seem to think of HIV testing as a routine part of medical care.
So we have a Twitter from Patty. She says, a coworker was HIV positive, and we had others asked, what do we do? Terrified like it was the Black Plague. People are still shockingly ignorant. So, Sarah, well, Blaine, what would you say to someone, particularly a colleague at work, who comes to you about HIV status? What are some better responses than responding like they have the bubonic plague?
Well, I think... There's an old saying that we are afraid of what we don't know, and so many people don't know about it in terms of, you know, the modern advances. So they immediately get scared and shut down and have a reaction. Oh, you know, this is a horrible thing. I'm going to get it just by drinking out of the same cup or sitting on the same toilet seat. I think that if people could gear themselves up a little bit, be more proactive to, hey, I have a friend, a colleague, a coworker. I work with this person, go to school with this person, live next to this person, and I've recently found this out. They must be going through something. What can I do to help? That might be a much better reaction because that would break the ice. It would then let the person who's going through that experience know that you're actually there and you care, rather than feeling isolated or pushed off to the side.
Well, and I think maybe there's still this sense that HIV is a gay man's disease, but there are a growing number of heterosexual women who have the disease. Sarah, what have you seen in that area, and are the reactions to heterosexual women who have the disease different?
I think they're even more isolated. The reality of being a heterosexual woman, especially if you're a woman of color, is that you may really not know anybody else who's positive. So we at the clinic at least work very hard to get them connected to each other so that they can find out that they're not alone. But oftentimes they feel very much alone, and their community may not really understand what it's like to live with that and to be maybe a mom or to be a provider. They're carrying an awful lot of burden, but they don't necessarily have the outreach efforts that might occur in the gay community.
So they're kind of even more stigmatized in a way because of that. Now, Mighty, what have you seen women who were pregnant with HIV, and what do the new treatments have to offer in terms of minimizing risk for infants?
If we can test women who are pregnant, get them on HIV treatment, the chance that their baby will have HIV is almost zero. Of course, nothing is 100%, but
what about women who may be reluctant to take the medicine, saying, you know, it might hurt my baby or it might...
In general, pregnant women want to do everything they can to have a healthy baby. In my career, I've only had one patient since I started treating people with HIV in 1993 that did not take her HIV medication when she was pregnant, and that person also had mental illness. So my experience has been that pregnant women do a really good job of taking their HIV medication when they're pregnant, so they will have a healthy baby.
Now, Mighty, just in terms of the transmission process, when you don't take the medicine, how is it passed on to the baby?
We're not exactly sure, but if it happens in utero or at the time when, you know, the baby is born. But we do know that without taking HIV medications, the risk that that baby will be HIV infected is about 30-40%. And if we can treat mom and do the usual protocol that we do, we also give the baby HIV medications for a month after the baby's born, the risk is less than 1%. Really, the national goal is to have zero babies born with HIV.
Now, in terms of, we all know that even for those of us who don't have HIV, adhering to medications is a problem, whether it's antibiotics and taking it till it's finished. How big of a problem is that? And then how does that increase risk for transmission when you skip doses or maybe you're not taking it as directed?
Well, all of my healthcare providers have told me to stay at least 85% consistent and not have to have an issue. Wanting to keep the level of medication in your system up to a level where it will keep the HIV at bay is the ultimate goal. Now, once you start playing around with it, if you start skipping too many or you drop below that 85%, you run the risk of creating, I believe, what's called a superinfection, where your HIV becomes resistant to that medication. And many times, if you're on one certain type, you can wipe out many of the available medications to treat HIV just by becoming resistant to one.
Now, Mighty, what's been your experience with adhering to whatever the doctor ordered in terms of HIV medications?
Well, my entire program of research at the University of Missouri is in helping people who have struggled with taking their HIV medicine as prescribed. As you pointed out, drug resistance is a real problem in this disease. Missing doses is the worst thing you can do. You're better off to just stop cold turkey. There are a lot of people in this country with HIV who are struggling with adherence to their treatment. And a small segment of the HIV population actually has a suppressed viral load. It's probably the biggest challenge in treating this disease is to keep people on treatment their whole life with a suppressed viral load.
And Sarah, as a case manager, how do you not only help people with adhering to their medication, but also connect them with other supports?
Well, as a therapist, what we really want to look at is, I take a pill to be healthy, not I take a pill to be sick. If I'm taking a pill to be healthy, then everything else I'm doing is to be healthy. I can live with this. There's no reason why it has to affect me, and I can have a full life. If I'm in that mind frame, then I'm willing to reach out to other people. I'm willing to take the chance that other people will want me in their lives.
So, Blaine, if there were one thing you could convey to someone who's either newly diagnosed or living with the disease, what advice would you give?
I would definitely say adhering to the medication is the biggest advice I can give. There might be some side effects in the very beginning, but the side effects definitely outweigh the negative of living the rest of whatever life you might have not taking the medication, because it would be very painful for not only you, but everybody else who's watching.
Now, briefly, how about you, Mighty? What advice do you give?
The same. That and to find a support system.
And Sarah, I'm going to ask you a slightly different question because you see people that have bad reactions from families. So what advice do you give family members or friends of people who are HIV infected, just briefly?
Well, I would tell anybody out there, there's no reason to be afraid. There's just none. There's no reason to think that you can't have these people in your life and that they don't have something to offer. If before that you knew that they were positive, they were great people, then they're still great people afterwards.
I want to thank our guests, Dr. Mighty Enriquez, nurse practitioner at Truman Medical Center, Sarah Nelson-Johns, counselor at KC Care Clinic, and Blaine O'Borney, patient expert. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow for KC Currents on Central Standard as we explore the rewards and challenges in raising children who are bilingual. Up to Date is next with former Talk of the Nation host Neil Conan and a new advocacy group, Grandmas Against Gun Violence. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Susan Wilson, and this is KCUR. Keep listening.